tonight on Arena. We review the stories of Ireland by Brian Friel and Alva Ní Briain on her tapestries, The Dream Pool Intervals. You can text us on 51551 or tweet at RT Arena or watch live on rt.ie/arena. We often hear writers talk of how intimidating the blank page can be and how hard it is to get started on a new project, no matter the subject matter. Well, a new series from RTE Radio 1 aims to get the nation's creative juices flowing, and it will do this by giving writers something to write about, in other words, a prompt. In fact, the new series is called The Prompt. It's presented by Zoe Cummins, but before the 8-part series kicks off on May the 25th, Zoe is looking for original pieces of writing to be included in each of the episodes. These pieces can be fiction, essay or poetry, whichever you like, but they must respond to one of the prompts provided by the 8 best-selling authors who will take part in the series. I'm delighted to be joined in studio by Zoe Cummins and from our Galway studio by Idel Coffey, who is one of the writers taking part in the series and who came up with one of the 8 prompts. But before we get to the prompts, what gave you the prompt or the creative spark for this series?
Well, Zoe, I really like the idea of working with prompts, because even when I'm walking around or I'm overhearing conversations or I'm listening to the radio, if I hear a little phrase or a word, I sometimes or often go and jot it down and think, oh gosh, that might be a really good way into a story or into a character. So the prompt was kind of born out of that. And also, from talking to a lot of writers over the years, I know that, as you said, it can be really difficult to get motivated or get started. And I know that writers love a deadline, because it kind of forces you to get something down on the page and get something done. So it came out of that as well. And they were the main motivators, to get people started and to give them a deadline to work towards, and also to give them a platform on the national airwaves to hear their work.
Now, during the series, you're going to be highlighting one of the prompts given by these individual writers.
Yeah, so there's a submission window open now until the 6th of April, and writers can go onto wearetheprompt.com and they can have a little look at the different prompts that are there. It's also accessible through RTE Culture, so you can have a little look there. And each of the guest writers have set a different prompt, and every week, for now, the submission window is open. When those submissions are in, the guest writers will read a short list, and then 3 pieces will be selected for each week of the series. So once we get to air, those writers and I will be discussing each week the submissions, but also writing techniques, how they go about their practice, and how they approach the page, because it could be quite daunting even for a seasoned writer.
Now, Idel Coffey, as I said, is joining us from the Galway studio. Idel, are you somebody who uses prompts?
Hi, Kay. Yes, I use them, but I don't use them specifically for my novels, but I find them very useful for exercises, or I like the idea of using a prompt to practice writing. I'm a big fan of a book called Writing Down the Bones by Natalie Goldberg. It's a very respected writing book, like a manual for how to write. And she talks about prompts and about it as a kind of a way of exercising your writing muscle, I suppose. And almost like, you know, other careers, they have continuous assessments or continuous learning. This is a way of sharpening your mind. If you use a prompt, you can sharpen your mind in terms of what you see as good material in your own life, just from day to day. Zoe mentioned there that listening to radio, sometimes you'll experience an idea. And that has happened to me so many times. In fact, I have the idea from my next novel, which was prompted by something I heard on the radio. And in my very first novel, I used an anonymous experience, which I'd heard on a radio chat show, just as a little sort of character vignette that I just was so intrigued by. And so using prompts as a way of opening up your mind, I think, a little bit, and opening yourself up, loosening yourself up a bit as a writer, because you can be very tense as a writer. You can think, oh, I have to write this specific thing. But prompts can loosen you up a bit. There's no pressure. It's very low stakes. And actually, when I'm doing workshops, I always use prompts, because suddenly people you have to take away all your crutches. You know, you might have a piece prepared and you've worked on it really hard. Everybody is at the same level when you use a prompt in that way.
Zoe, Adele was there talking about ideas. What's the difference between an idea and a prompt?
Well, I mean, a prompt is a way into an idea. So it's kind of a safe space in which to explore an idea. It isn't necessarily the idea in itself. It can just remind you of something. It can be in a way into exploring memory. So, for example, Belinda McKeown has set a prompt, which is shoes, but she specifically wants you to think about three pairs of shoes. So a pair of shoes when you were a child, one as an adolescent and one as an adult. And then from those, write about those pairs of shoes and take from that one of those pairs and use that as a way into a story. So it's not an end in itself. It's just a way into an idea.
Right. But you know, that's so emotional. Already
yes,
I'm
does.
Thinking of the three shoes, the three pairs of shoes and very specific emotional experiences. It's very representative of exactly what a prompt can do. It just kind of gets your creative juices flowing.
So Adele, what was your prompt?
My prompt was an unexpected package. And I chose that because I love tension and I love mystery in stories and in novels. And I just like the idea of the unexpected. And a prompt for me has to be abstract. It has to be broad enough for the writer to bring their own idea, their own personality, their own interest to the prompt. If you have something so specific that it's exclusionary, or if you have a prompt that is maybe about dragons, for example, it might not be to everybody's taste. But if you use something as vague as an unexpected package, I mean, that could be somebody retiring, that could be somebody expecting a child, it could be a literal package from the postman, but it has so much scope for leading anywhere. You can write any kind of story there. And, you know, so many questions as well, like who is the package from? What is the package? Who's receiving it? Who's delivering it? How does it change this person or their lives?
And would you expect then the person to write the story based on this unopened package, and that it might be a small section of a story that has nothing to do with the package, or it's the central theme of the story?
Oh, absolutely. No expectations whatsoever. It can be just, for me, prompts are always just your access into a story. It's like somebody giving you a key to a door. You open the door and whatever you find there, that's your story, not necessarily the prompt itself. So really, that is, for me, the purpose of a prompt. It's to reduce the pressure, to take away the pressure of the blank page, get you writing and get your sort of creativity flowing in a way that it doesn't if you have a giant project in front of you. Maybe I'm just about to hand in my third novel, so maybe I'm slightly biased here, but prompts are just that opening into the story. It doesn't have to be, in fact I prefer a prompt not to hem you in or pen you in any way, because that defeats the purpose. I think it should be completely open. Brainstorm a prompt, you know, see where it takes you. Don't go with maybe your very first literal interpretation of the prompt.
Yes, Zoe, because going through the prompts here that have been provided by the writers taking part, Ashley Adele's is the longest. She has three words in her prompt. As you said, Belinda's is the shortest. There's only one word, shoes. Give us an idea of the other ones. So it's about something that just means something or may mean something to you that triggers you off.
Yeah, so there's a lot of different approaches to even the prompt. They can be character driven, they can be setting driven. So Wendy Erskine is one of the prompters, and her prompt is Dark Horse. So are we talking about a character? Are we talking about a pub? Are we talking about a secret that somebody holds? So there's a lot of different ways into that. Another prompt is Keelan Hughes, which she has chosen embarrassment. And I think this is really interesting because emotion is a really important way into a character. And she has, not only with the word embarrassment, but she's given a few little instructions on how you're to think about that. You're not to go for the most sort of obvious stories that we all might have about being embarrassed, but you're to think about who the character is, where they are, and, you know, try and access something that's really deeply felt but very, very difficult to explain. So you're given sort of 750 words to try and explain that feeling.
Right. And then Mike McCormack's is interesting.
Yes, his starts with dot, 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 and it's the patron saint of. So really what he's challenging the writer to do is find the character that's going to step into those shoes of being the patron saint of whatever it is you want, and who's calling them the patron saint and why. So he is really leaving that open to people to go wherever they want with it, but bearing in mind it might be a real patron saint or it might be somebody slagging somebody off in a pub, as we do often in Ireland. So that's maybe a character-driven one. And then Sinead Moriarty has a prompt, A World Without. So that's trying to explore maybe some of the things that we take for granted, and if they were taken away, what kind of world would we be living in then? And there's Dave Rudden, who has Tearing It Down. Now, Dave Rudden writes for young adults, he writes for children, he writes speculative fiction. So this could be political, it could be anarchic, it could be self-destruction, it could be home redecoration. We don't know, so you can find your way into that yourself as a writer. But it really is open-ended, like Adele said. It's not sort of boxing you in too much. It's just giving you a way for your story to take flight.
Yes. And as you were listening to those prompts there, Adele, did you think, oh, yeah, I can see why they're good prompts and why they would, you know, elicit good responses?
Yes, I'm already thinking of ideas. I love Keelan Hughes's one, the idea of the embarrassment, because it not only does it conjure up an emotion, it also inherently conjures up plots, all sorts of plots, because we've all been embarrassed or we've all had an embarrassment, and we can probably come up with five very good plots off the top of our heads. But yeah, that the thing about prompts that is also really enjoyable, particularly for a show like this, writers can just enter, aspiring writers, is that it's very empowering. You don't have to come up with an idea. It's not that pressure of coming up with an amazing concept for a story or a novel or a high concept idea. You can actually just respond to the prompt. And that in itself is very liberating and very empowering, I think, for people who want to write, because you can just take it where you want to. And it's always going to be individual, because nobody will have the same response to a prompt that you will have.
And I think we didn't mention Lucy Caldwell's.
Lucy Caldwell is really interesting, because I think her prompt, which is irrevocable change, is a really good way to look at any piece of writing and any way into it. Because the most interesting piece of writing happen to people who, by the end of the story, something has changed so dramatically in them that they're a different person, or something has happened that the world is not the same again. So she has given sort of instructions that from the beginning of the story to the end, or the essay or the poem, something has to have changed dramatically. And I think that's a really good prompt, because it is making sure that you make a dramatic action within this story.
Now, you said about the dark horse, you said it could be this, it could be that, it could be the name of a pub, for example. So in other words, it's these prompts are not necessarily the theme, or not necessarily the title of the story.
No, and a really good book on writing is by George Saunders, A Swim in the Pond in the Rain. And he says something in it which I think is really important. He says, your piece of writing shouldn't do everything. It should just do something. So this piece of writing is not to try and encompass the prompt exactly. It's just to have a shade of it or a shadow of it. It's to use your way into this piece of writing. And I think that's really good, because many writers, all writers probably try to do too much until they edit, and then they edit down and edit down, and they get this sort of the essence of their idea and what they're trying to get across on the page. So as a writer entering or submitting to this, you should try to do a simple thing on the page and not try to pack too much into 750 words. Of course, in poetry, for these submissions, it can be shorter. But still, don't try to do too much. Keep it simple.
And right, as somebody who usually tries to force about four novels into one novel, don't feel bad if you are trying to do too much.
Yeah, I'm sure people don't say, oh, there's four novels in this, Adele, do they?
My editor literally did say that about a second novel that never saw the light of day. So that's OK.
So does advice like that, those kind of prompty advice, does that make you say, that's exactly what she's hit the nail on the head there by saying four novels in one?
Are you talking to me, Kay?
Yes, after you stop being sour.
Oh, absolutely, sure. The editor always wants the same thing that you want. You just have to remind yourself of that, which is they want the book to be the best book it can be. But actually, second novels are difficult. And when I was writing my second novel, which actually didn't become the second novel that was published, I wrote a different one. But that second one, it was very much about like trying to be ambitious and trying to do everything. Like Zoe said, you're trying to do everything. You're trying to do something really dramatic and big. And actually what you need to do is just focus on the most important thing, the essence, and something simple. Because just because something's simple, it doesn't mean that it's not complex. I know that sounds like an oxymoron, but it's a simple thing. You think of the biology of a flower. We think a flower is simple, but it's, of course, one of the most complex creations on the planet. So if you think of a simple idea and executing a simple idea, some of the cleanest, most simple writers, take the beautiful work of Claire Keegan. Who of us could hope to achieve writing like that? Even though it appears simple, it's very profound, actually.
Now, Zoe, getting back to the programme. So people will have submitted their work. It'll be read. You'll have chosen some examples of how people responded to the individual prompts. And then is their work read out on air? And then do the writers discuss how they dealt with the prompt?
So the aim is that the writers who write the pieces will read the pieces themselves on air. And for example, in the programme with Adele, and I will chat to Adele about the submissions, but we'll also talk about writing techniques, we'll talk about influences, we'll talk about approaches and how somebody like Adele sits down every day and writes a piece of work. But we won't necessarily be critiquing the submissions, but we will be looking at the approaches that they took to the prompt. And of course, if they've made it to air, they're going to be of a good standard. So it's going to be great to listen to them. But it's also going to be fascinating to see the sort of different angles that people have approached these prompts from. And that's what we're going to be discussing.
OK, so tell us again, there's a deadline of Sunday, the 6th of April at 12 p.m. So that's 750 words, unless it's a poem.
Exactly. So it can be fiction, it can be non-fiction, it can be memoir, it can be poetry, up to 750 words or shorter if it's poetry. You go on to wearetheprompt.com and you can have a little look at the submissions. All of the prompters are up there and all of the titles of the prompts, and there is a submission facility. And also in this submission facility, there's a way you can upload a little piece of audio, whether it be from your phone or from your computer. And that will give you the opportunity as a writer, because these pieces are going to be read on air, gives you an opportunity as a writer to see what's working when you listen back to it yourself.
So it's okay just to send in an audio piece?
It is, and the written piece as well. But it gives you the opportunity to say, well, this is working really well because I'm listening back to it myself.
All right. So, and there's a form on, as you say, RT Culture or We Are The Prompt. Is that
We Are The Prompt.com.
We Are The Prompt.com.
That's it.
Zoe Cummins and Adele Coffey, thank you so much. And the series will be on RT Radio 1 beginning Sunday, May the 25th at 7 p.m. During a summer trip to Donegal, I had the good fortune to attend a night in Glenties in aid of the planned new Brian Friel Centre. One of the joys of the night was listening to actor Charlie Bonner reading a Brian Friel short story, Mr. Singh, My Heart's Delight, about an ageing woman and her young grandson who she amuses with fantastical tales and adventures. Into their cottage, perched on a cliff face, comes a foreign visitor, a salesman of exotic silks who turns the woman's heart upside down. Brian Friel is, of course, famous for plays like Translation and Dancing at Lunasa, but he was also a master of the short story. It was where he began in the 1950s, and it was the popularity of his stories in the New Yorker magazine which allowed him to become a full-time writer in 1960. Penguin have just reissued a collection that first came out in 1979 called Stories of Ireland. Mary McGill has been reading them for us, and she joins me now from Galway. Mary, 9 of the 13 stories in this collection were first published in the New Yorker. It's hard to imagine the confidence it must have given the young Brian Friel, who was a teacher, who wanted to be a full-time writer, to get his work published in the New Yorker.
It's absolutely astonishing, Kay, to think about. I mean, 9 stories in The New Yorker is such an achievement. The New Yorker being such a kind of a stamp of approval, but one of the main stamps of approval in terms of literary endeavour and achievement. And in reading these short stories, I found myself wondering why I hadn't come across them before, because he is a master of the form. That's why he was in The New Yorker. And it's so interesting because, when I was growing up in Ireland in the 90s, Brian Friel was everywhere. He was celebrated, as he still is, as one of our greatest ever storytellers. So there is something really delightful in a collection like this to go back to these early stories, which were celebrated in their own right, and to see the seeds of what would become, for example, Philadelphia, Here I Come, or what would become Dancing at Lunasa. And it's wonderful, just as you pointed out there, so many of the stories here, and you talked about a beautiful one there with Mr. Singh, My Heart's Delight, but, we meet characters who are trapped and impoverished and who are looking for a way out. And I suppose perhaps for Friel, the support of The New Yorker allowed him to do that. It gave him the time and space to commit to writing fully. And just 3 years after 1960, when he took up writing full time, he produced Philadelphia, Here I Come, and he really didn't look back after that. So yes, this is a real, it's a real treasure.
Yes, because we know The New Yorker for helping the careers of Mary Lavin, Brendan Behan, mm-hmm. and famously Maeve Brennan, I think, as well. But, you don't think of Brian Friel as part of that short story set, because I suppose he just had such huge success in America, in New York and on Broadway with plays like Philadelphia.
Yeah, I mean, he's a Laurence Olivier Award winning. He is Tony Award winning for Dancing at Lunasa. But I did find myself wondering, I thought back to my own education in Mary Lavin and Brendan Behan and the short stories we did for Junior Cert and Leaving Cert. And I really wondered why he wasn't there, like why he wasn't in the mix. Because, and that will tell you something about the calibre of this collection, because they absolutely reach the heights of your Mary Lavins and then your Brendan Behans. And they also, I think, as well, lend a real kind of richness then to when you do come to the plays, because now I see, he had, right from the very beginning of his career as a writer, he had this whole landscape, internal and external, of Donegal, of Ballybeg, this literally in Irish, Ballybeog, the small town, and these stories, and more than his plays, the orientator and the people and the landscapes of Donegal, which you just mentioned. Shout out to Glenty, he's a great part of the world, and Tyrone as well. And so it's really, I think, for fans of Friel's plays, they will find so much in this collection that will make those connections come alive for them again.
Now, the stories were written, as you say, in the 50s, so it's very much 20th century Ireland. It's a very rural Ireland, full of animal stories, manual labour, poverty, as you said, but lots of fun as well.
So much fun. I mean, you mentioned in Mr. Singh, My Heart's Delight, to give you a sense of how isolated that wonderful, vivacious, beautiful granny is. She says to her young grandson, who's telling the story from his perspective, she says to him, "Were you ever in a bus? Was it bad on the stomach, was it?" And you just get these perfectly timed moments of comedy dialogue that just gives this lovely singing levity to proceedings, because Friel can be incredibly tender and he never shies away from capturing the tragedies and cruelties of life. But in the same beat, he can move into comedy in a way that never jars and always rings true. And I think, again, what you see in these stories is his amazing capacity and his amazing timing in relation to dialogue and capturing people as they talk. As they talk, yes, but also while revealing their inner lives. So what we say versus how we feel and what we do, and all of the complexities therein. So this is, there's a lot of joy here. There's a lot of fun, but there's a lot of depth too.
Yes, there's a lot of fun. In The Gold in the Sea, for example, it's four men out in a boat. One con is a bit of a bore. But then there's this young fella, Lipsy, and he just keeps saying, these old boring trite statements of, and they make no sense. They're all out of context, and we get a great laugh from them. He says things like, I can't remember now what he says, but it's all kind of cliche things. Oh, look before you leap, and that nobody's going to leap anywhere. But they're all looking at him, throwing their eyes up to heaven.
So, and you know, when I remember reading that and been like, this would work so well on stage as well. Like, there are parts of these stories you could just read them aloud. You could bring in your actors and you could sit around and you could read them aloud, just as you're describing there, and you could absolutely imagine them in a theatre setting. So it's almost the constellation of Friel's work. We get another aspect to it in this collection of short stories.
Then we get also, there is great fun in it too, for people who know his plays, to see yes. kind of echoes or forebodings of subjects that will come up in the play. I think Louise Kennedy, who writes an introduction to this, sees early version of Frank Hardy from The Faith Healer in two of the stories. She says the illusionist and the diviner, these men with kind of superpowers who come into the village and kind of throw people out of kilter.
Yes, I mean, I had a moment when I was reading one of the stories called A Man's World, and in it you get five sisters, I think, in Ballybeg, and immediately I was like, this is Dancing at Lunasa. It has to be. And there are huge parallels between it's a Man's World, a short story, and Dancing at Lunasa. So yes, exactly. I think if you know, and like, I mean, who doesn't know at least some of Friel's work at this stage? You will read this collection and you will make those connections. And there is a real richness to that. And I think it's wonderful as well to kind of see that even from very on in his career, he knew what he wanted to write about and he knew who these characters and these people were, and they were always so alive to him. And I think even with characters that he's not maybe, they're maybe not the best people, or, you know, they're struggling in difficult circumstances, he has a real respect for everyday people and he always writes them with such dignity and such grace and depth. And I think that, you know, this really, these are stories, Kay, about ordinary people in ordinary situations, and yet he manages to find the profundity in the everyday over and over and over again.
So there's two stories at least, which is about Friel, who writing about a father and son, a father who is a teacher. There's My Father and the Sergeant is one of those stories, saying a little bit like Gar Public and Gar Private, the father yeah. is one thing at home and he's another thing in the school. Tell us yes. a little bit about that story.
Well, I'm fascinated by these stories about the son and his father teaching him, because Friel was taught by his own father. So I find that dynamic very interesting. And I'm one of many Irish people who have had the pleasure of being taught by a parent as well. And it's
oh, really?
Very interesting, yeah, to see it worked out on the page. And so My Father and the Sergeant, the sergeant is actually in that title, the sergeant is the father's nickname. And so you're so right. We see that convention that he used in Philadelphia, Here I Come, between Gar 1 and Gar 2, right? So you have this one person, but two very striking and two very different aspects of them. And he, you know, he really struggles with this as a young boy, because on the one hand, he loves his father, and his father at home is very tender with him. But in the classroom, it's a completely different environment. And his father is also struggling with his own thwarted ambitions. So it's a kind of story where, and there's something in it as well that happens. And as you said, this is very much Ireland in the 20th century. I won't give too much away about it, but it kind of is jaw-dropping in terms of how it's approached in the story versus how it would be approached now. And then in The Illusionist, we return to the same father and son again. And we meet a kind of quasi-friend of the father, who's this travelling magician, and initially the son absolutely idolises this man, but as the story progresses, the relationship between the father and the travelling musician is revealed to be more about their own personal need for self-delusion than it is anything to aspire to, and this becomes very disappointing for the young boy. And again, another theme running through these stories comes to the fore very much in The Illusionist, is this sense of childhood ending, and often ending in the course of an afternoon or an evening. And as some kind of Rubicon has been crossed, even though the child may not fully understand it yet, that they can't go back, you know, that they have been forced into a more adult world.
Yes, because he has, you can see this operatic set piece within the illusionist, where the father, who is the teacher, as you say, and the illusionist, this man who comes into town, and they're having this kind of bickering session, both talking about the greatness of their own lives. And it's a beautifully constructed piece.
Yes, they're both complete. And again, it's one of those pieces you can see working amazingly on stage. They're both talking past each other, but that they're quite satisfied to do that because it's almost like cathartic for both of them. Their relationship is based on them affirming each other's nonsense. Eventually, of course, this becomes unsustainable. They have a disagreement, a very drunken disagreement, and they end up having a big fight, and that is the end of the relationship. And, you know, the young boy's mother kind of steps in to cool everything down. But it is so well observed, and the rhythm of that conversation, such as it is, going back and forth between them, you utterly, like, they believe in their nonsense and you believe that they believe in their nonsense. So it's at once kind of tragic to see that they have this need to kind of fool themselves and each other, but utterly believable.
And do you think that some of the stories, I don't know if sentimental is the right reason, but there is definitely a bit more of sentiment and that kind of pathos in them than in some of the plays. And some of the plays can be a little harsher, I think.
Yeah, I was really struck. I think you're right. I was really struck by one story in particular called Among the Ruins, where, you know, a grown man returns with his own young family to where he grew up. And it's one of those, he initially doesn't want to go, then he goes and he is, you know, he thinks it's going to be actually quite nice and enjoyable, but it turns out to be rather bittersweet. He realises that his memories are a lot more sunny than the reality of what he actually finds when he returns home. And I think, you know, perhaps that could have been played a lot more cruelly, as in, well, of course, what did you expect? But there's a real tenderness in this story, both for the man in how he responds to his own children after having this realisation, but also how he responds to himself. You know, how he becomes aware of himself as a child and how that is carried forward through his life and through his engagement with his children as well. So, yes, there's a real kind of, it's not sickly sweet, but there is something quite lovely and tender in it that, yeah, I think perhaps you mightn't get to the same degree in some of his plays.
Now, we're talking about, as we say, Ireland in the mid-century, the 1950s, and poverty is a theme throughout the stories. It's in The Potato Gatherers, which is a very funny story, but it's, you know, but that whole poverty of the young boys skipping school and wondering, will they even be able to get the money that they're going to earn from picking potatoes and getting into awful trouble at school for skipping. And even in My Lovely Mr. Singh, My Heart's Delight, that poor woman was left to in poverty by her jealous husband.
Exactly. I mean, in Mr. Singh, My Heart's Delight, the way that the grandmother and the travelling salesman end up forming this bond or this appreciation for each other is, you know, she has nothing. She lives in a one room shack, effectively. But she shares what she has with him because he's been travelling, you know, for so long and he's exhausted and the weather is terrible. So she feeds him, she lets him stay, and she shows him that this is incredible kindness. But as a reader, you're going, well, what exceptional kindness, because she herself has so little. And again, with The Potato Gatherers, there's this real innocence to the two boys who, you know, are so excited initially to begin to gather a few potatoes to get some money, and they have grand ideas what they're going to buy with this money. Oh, they're going to do all kinds of things. But as the story progresses, you realise, no, actually, you know, they're there because their family needs that money. And they're, if they see any of it at all, they will be very lucky. And again, it's one of those stories, just in the last couple of paragraphs, it goes from that lovely levity and, you know, having this adventure to absolutely breaking your heart, because the younger character, you know, he's absolutely exhausted at the end of the day. And again, it's that movement from the kind of innocence and joy of childhood into this more adult terrain that has to do with class and poverty and providing for your family. And you know they're going to get into trouble the next day for missing school, even though they're out there collecting potatoes to feed themselves and their siblings and their parents. So it's, yes, there is a real kind of, and I think there's something as well, Kay, about being reminded of that. This is not that long ago in terms of Irish history, you know, this level of poverty that I'm, you know, many of our grandparents would have been very familiar with. And it's sobering to think about, you know, how far in some respects we have come from that.
Yes, and there's also an exploration, isn't there, of the class system within that very small community and that very defined people who have jobs, people who have land. I think you were you picked out the Foundry House as an example of that, Mary.
Yeah, and this is a very interesting story because it captures times when a shift was occurring. But I don't know that people could articulate it necessarily. And what Friel hones in on is that you have this upper middle class Irish Catholic family who had a high standing in the community. But that is beginning to fall away now. Their grand house is in decay. This is the Hogan family. The son has become a priest. The daughter has become a nun and she's away in the missions in Africa, unlikely ever to return home. And we're contrasted that, you know, that context with Joe, who grew up in the gatehouse, which was part of their domain. And he's now a radio engineer and he's got this huge family. And he, you know, goes up to the once, you know, venerated, you know, very glamorous Foundry House. And he finds a building, but also a family and a way of life as well that is in decay, that is in decline. And then when he returns to his own house, which is cramped and you know, I think he's got 9 kids and it's full of energy and full of life, you wonder if Friel is making some statement about maybe regeneration and the way, you know, one way of being in the world ends and then something else comes to replace it. But the contrast that he draws in that story are very powerful.
Yes, and again, you're talking there about they having, was it 8 or 9 children? Also, was it in The Ginger Hero, which is a great story about cockfighting? Yes. But really, it's about something else. It's about women's lives and women being it being so restricted by having an awful lot of children or being liberated in some way by not having children.
Yes, and I think there's a real, you know, in that story, there's a real expression of female desire, you know, and there was no judgment that I could pick up on. And there was a kind of inevitability to the way two of the characters end up getting together, even though it would have been hugely transgressive by the standards of the day. And the way Friel writes it, it feels very, you know, well, obviously that was going to happen, even though it's slightly shocking on the page. And it is, I mean, he does, there's a kind of a recognition that he gives his female characters who are often struggling financially, emotionally, work-wise, because they're raising huge families, or their aunts who are contributing to keeping you know, their nieces and nephews on the road, as the case may be. And he recognises that. And in contrast, you know, we often see male characters, not always, but not infrequently either, who are feckless, who have problems with alcohol, who are, for example, you know, wanting to go cockfighting and want to go pigeon racing and dreaming of the next big thing, while the female characters are grounded in the reality of everyday family life and what that entails. And again, that is testament to his ability to really mine the richness of everyday dynamics and draw out what is, you know, very recognisably tensions within the traditional Irish family unit.
Well, I think we would both highly recommend Stories of Ireland by Brian Friel. It's got an introduction by Louise Kennedy. Mary McGill, thank you so much for reading the stories for us. Stories of Ireland by Brian Friel is published by Penguin. We now turn to an engaging new exhibition that includes images of destroyed buildings, Victorian photographs and extinct animals. Presented as tapestries, the artist Alvin Ivrian is well known for creating visually rich collages from a diverse range of materials. Alvin Ivrian, The Dream Pool Intervals is the exhibition, and it includes 5 large tapestries. It opens on March the 27th at the Hugh Lane Gallery, and I'm delighted that Alva joins me in studio now before she has to spend all her time mounting the exhibition.
Thank you.
You're nearly there, yeah?
Yeah, almost there.
These are big, these tapestries.
They are. They're kind of almost cinematic in their scale. They're about 3 metres high and kind of between 4 and 4.5 metres wide. So it's quite an encounter.
Yes, and they're tapestries, so they're woven.
They're woven. They're Jacquard tapestries. So they're woven on the Jacquard loom and translated from digital collage.
And so do you make the digital collage first of all?
Yeah, that's usually the longest part of the process. And this is, it's part of an ongoing series, the interval series, of which there are 8 large scale tapestries so far. So I kind of tend to work on them as a series and move between them. But it can take, you know, almost 2 years to finalise one of those collages. And then you begin the process of translation into tapestry. And it is very much translation. It's not reproduction. It is a whole other kind of world of possibility and material decisions that open up.
And when did you begin to weave, or when did you learn that whole art?
I first started working in tapestry, I guess it's almost 10 years ago. But my background is in printmaking. So I think there's something about the translation of the photographic image to different mediums is kind of probably just baked into my DNA as a maker. So, yeah, it was something I was kind of curious about. And I've always found the photographic image kind of frustrating, and that I always kind of want to get beneath its surface in some way, or interrupt it. So I think that's where the impulse for collage comes from. And it's really satisfied then by Jacquard tapestry, where you have these kind of intensely dynamic surfaces.
Yes, just go into the Jacquard the way of weaving. There's a whole, like, it was a precursor of computing.
Yes, and I think that's really interesting, because obviously it's this really richly historic form of storytelling. And you kind of think of it as a kind of something that's kind of in the ancient past. But actually, in the 1800s, when the Jacquard loom was invented, it was the first application of binary code. So it kind of operated like the first computer. So my practice for a long time was very much embedded in film and computer-generated imagery. And I was just spending so much time in kind of wireframes and virtual worlds that I was kind of craving something tactile and something with a material presence. But there was also that link which really drew me to working with Jacquard, that kind of backward application of technology, which has so much more to do with the virtual worlds of CGI than you kind of imagine at first glance.
So is the Jacquard loom now like it was back in the you know, its foundational time, or has it become almost computerized itself?
It is computerized, but I think one of the things that is most striking to me when working with it is that it's still, it's just this enormous, fascinating beast of a machine that is still needs to be tended by hand from start to finish. And yeah, it's a fascinating process. But you are literally, you know, I'm working a lot with silk and with lurex. So, you know, the tension can really build with a large tapestry like the ones that I'm making. And threads break really frequently. And you have to go in by hand, find that broken thread, and retie it by hand, and then start this intense juddering machine, you know, to work again. So it's really quite a spectacle. And there is, yeah, it is, there is nothing just push a button and out comes the tapestry. It's a long and kind of loving process in making one.
And how do you tell it what to do? Is it punching?
Yeah, I mean, now again, those things are mechanised, but there are still the punch cards.
Oh, right.
So the digital file.
Back then,
it was punch cards.
Yes.
So now, I mean, you still call it punching, but it's a digital file that you're sending through.
Okay. So we'll get on to the images. We have 2 images that we're going to tweet now at RTE Arena, Interval 7 and Interval 3. So the images use photography as one of its bases. Maybe we talk about that first. And they seem like almost models of Victorian formal portraiture.
Yes.
We don't see we see, let's say, the bodies sitting in a formal fashion. Mm-hmm. But then when it gets maybe to the heads, they don't have heads, or you're wondering what's in the place of their heads. So talk to us again. You talked there about photography and about trying to dig in behind photographs.
Yeah, I mean, these are, I guess, the most striking element when you look at the tapestries is that strand of archival photographic portraiture. And you're right, they're mostly Victorian era, not entirely, but in the main they are. And I think there's something about that era of photography. It's kind of the early invention of photography and how it dates from the height of kind of industrial and imperial power. And when you look at a lot of those photographs, you really start to see that they are encoded and kind of inscribed with a lot of those kind of ideologies of dominance or myths of superiority. And I've always drawn to, I think, that time in history, just because of how much it has affected our contemporary world. So I'm overlaying these photographs then with, like you said, these images of contemporary images of destroyed buildings. So images of architecture that has been destroyed by war or by climate disaster. So in a way, I'm looking at those as the kind of ongoing present day legacies of those same forces that we're kind of currently living with. And then the third kind of rogue element that's interrupting the formal portraiture are images of underground caves and tunnels and stalagmites and stalactites. So they're all kind of lurking beneath these formal portraits and kind of sometimes penetrating the surface of that placid illusion.
Does that come from your County Clare background, where everything, let's say you think of the Burren and Alwi, and always underneath there's as much as there is above?
That's really interesting. And maybe everything does come from the Burren for me, because there's definitely something of how those caves connect to a register of kind of deep time and that kind of geological time that's kind of humming beneath all of our human progress and chaos, which I think you're very aware of that in the Burren. A lot of the noise falls away and you kind of tune into that. But also within those underground spaces, I'm thinking a lot about mythologies of the underworld and ideas of these kind of narratives that we've used across so many cultures to frame, I guess, the human fear of death. So there's a circularity in how I'm using those images, in that I'm thinking about the fear of death is probably the thing that has driven all of this intense urge towards, you know, progress and domination. And at the moment, that's kind of colliding with itself in this very strange moment and leaving us with this very uncertain future that's then turning us back to these very ancient fears of our own disappearance.
Now, there are animals, wonderful animals in this. I don't know, some of them may be dead, some of them may be extinct. There's birds of prey, there's a wolf, then I don't know if it's a coyote or a wolf-like animal in the images. Where are they coming from?
They are the kind of the most intact presence in the tapestries. Like you mentioned, a lot of the human figures have their faces removed. So they're just giving way to these glimpses of you know, rock formations and cityscapes. But the animals look back at you. And I think I use animals a lot in my work just as a way of kind of touching on this other form of consciousness. And I guess one that we're about to lose altogether, potentially. So all of these animals are either extinct or endangered. But they also loop back into what I was talking about, these narratives of the underworld. So, you know, these different animals across different narratives were thought to occupy the threshold to the underworld or accompany you on your journey into the unknown. So I'm kind of threading this imagined link between ancient narratives of the underworld and contemporary threats of extinction with these animals that meet your gaze.
And the people then are present, but they've been taken over by these kind of empty frames of faces a lot of the time.
Exactly. They kind of, the figures become reduced to a series of rehearsed poses and gestures. We're no longer able to kind of go into the portrait with a kind of an identification with the individual, which is what usually draws us in. Instead, we're just left with seeing them as kind of players and subjects within a wider project. And yeah, seeing the photograph itself as a construct.
Well, Alva Nivrian, thank you so much for coming in. Alva's exhibition, The Dream Pool Intervals, begins at the Hugh Lane Gallery on March the 27th and runs until September the 28th. HughLane.ie for more information. That's it for tonight's show. Liam Murphy and Paula Shields were the researchers. James Feeney was on sound. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. And tonight's show was produced by Sinead Egan. John Creedon is next after the news.